Esquire. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to get this right this time. I missed it up the last time. Chief Judge, Senior Judge, pleasure to see you back on the bench, sir. Members of the court, it was a pleasure to be here. It's significantly warmer than when I was here last month. Members of the court, the issues in this case, as the court knows, are fairly succinct. The appellant was denied his Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser when the military judge permitted testimonial hearsay in the form of SL statements to two different physicians. This evidence violated MRE 803, United States v. Crawford, and this court's precedents in United States v. Gardenia. SL statements to Dr. Montgomery, and even more certainly to Dr. Hyden, were inadmissible hearsay and violative of the Sixth Amendment. Your Honor, this court is well aware of the well-settled test in United States v. Gardenia and Rankin. And that is, when deciding whether or not statements made to a physician are admissible as an exception to the hearsay rule, well, this court looks to three things. Whether the statements were made, or elicited or made in response to a law enforcement or prosecutorial inquiry, whether they involved more than just a routine cataloging of facts, and whether the primary purpose for eliciting or making those statements was with an eye towards trial. And what I would like to do, members of the court, is to discuss this.
Just to hammer the point home, you're here then arguing Gardenia, not arguing that Gardenia is incorrectly decided, adjusted by Bryant. It's in line and in queue with all operative precedent right now.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So this is how does it apply, X or Y?
That's correct, Judge. That is the appellant's position. And, Your Honor, what I would like to do.
Counsel, before you go on, would you agree that that your argument is stronger with respect to Dr. Hyden than it is with respect to Dr. Campbell?
I would. Dr. Montgomery, sorry. Yes, ma'am. That's certainly
the opposite. And why is that?
Well, it's for two reasons, Judge, and that's what I was just getting ready to discuss. And what I'd like to do is to discuss the statements to the two different physicians and look at the three factors from United States versus Virginia. And, Your Honor, with your permission, I'd like to start with the statement for Dr. Montgomery and then expound on that as it relates to the statement with Dr. Hyden. As it relates to Dr. Montgomery, as the court knows by the joint appendix, she conducted what she described as a cursory examination of SL, and that she knew that that the allegation was a possible sexual assault. She knew that the records would become part of a criminal case. Importantly, as it relates to both of these physicians, Your Honors, and certainly as it relates to Dr. Hyden, as I'll discuss in response to Judge Ryan's question in just a second, these records were maintained in an evidence-cataloging manner. What I mean by that is, as Dr. Hyden discussed, and Dr. Montgomery to a lesser degree, they collected the evidence in accordance with the forms that they were provided in order to allow them to catalog the evidence. And we believe that that is extremely important as it relates to both physicians. Dr. Montgomery, in particular, knew that she had to safeguard the evidence, as she called it. And it's important that during Dr. Montgomery's testimony, she consistently referred to it as evidence, not as statements.
Well, what evidence did Dr. Montgomery collect? I mean, she didn't collect any evidence. She did a physical examination.
I would argue, Judge, that she did collect evidence, and the statements just, it's kind of like when a client calls me and says that there's no evidence against me. I say, well, there is, because what people say is evidence.
Under your argument, any statement made to a medical doctor ever that happened to involve an allegation or criminal offense would be testimonial, and I don't think that that's the law in any jurisdiction in the country.
And that's not what my claim is, Judge. Judge, specifically as it relates to this case, I think it's important that the court understand two separate things. One is, the appellant has no qualm with a doctor collecting information from a patient. That's perfectly normal. The question is whether or not that information is admissible in a trial of court-martial.
And you would apply the primary purpose test.
That is one of the three tests.
Gardenier and Bryant.
That is one of the three tests that the court applies, yes, Your Honor.
And why is the fact that this form or that form is being used at the time that someone is conducting a medical exam, how does that make that the primary purpose?
Simply this, Your Honor. The forms themselves, I think that was the second point that I was getting ready to address with Judge Ryan's question. It segues very well into yours. The question isn't necessarily whether or not the information collected in an individual case was with an eye towards prosecution. These forms are promulgated with a specific purpose. The forms in this case, and especially the forms that relates to Dr. Hyden, had a space on the bottom for a police report. And respectfully, Your Honor, the government shouldn't be able to do the equivalent of handing a witness a blank police statement and say, just fill this out if anything ever happens, and then say, well, we didn't know that there was a crime involved. Obviously, in this case, the forms themselves are delineated with a specific purpose, and that purpose is to gather evidence to use in the prosecution of a criminal case.
Counsel, would you agree with this statement that to the extent you can bring the medical doctor as standing more in the shoes of law enforcement or a government agent, the closer you are to meeting step one of Rankin and Garnier, et cetera, et cetera?
Absolutely.
Okay, so explain then, under that theory, how Dr. Campbell, or whatever her name is, the first doc, I just have her, Dr. 1 and Dr. 1 and Dr. 2, emergency room Dr. 1.
Okay. Dr. 1, Dr. Montgomery, completed a form that asked for the name of a perpetrator. There would be no reason in a typical medical examination to know the name of the perpetrator. And the best analogy I can give you, Judge, is if somebody comes into the emergency room and says, I broke my arm in a car accident, I got whiplash, I suffered an injury. The driver of the vehicle is irrelevant. The driver of the vehicle that hit her. The only reason why the name of the driver that hit that person is relevant is for the purposes of a criminal prosecution. As it relates to a medical treatment, the name of the driver of the car that hit her is completely irrelevant. Similarly, in this case, the form specifically used by Dr. Montgomery, Dr. One, and Judge Lyons question was used and indicated on itself. It was a pediatric alleged physical abuse form.
But isn't it important for the doctor to know the type of injury and therefore to know what happened to the alleged victim?
It may very well be, but again, Judge, the question isn't whether or not it's important for that doctor to know that. The question is whether or not those statements that come from that person are admissible under United States v. Crawford and Cardinier.
If they're there for a medical examination because they went to the emergency room and the emergency room physician is doing a typical emergency room diagnosis, don't you think that for medical purposes it's reasonable for them to say, well, what happened to you? Did you get hit in the head by a 2x4? Did you fall off the sidewalk? I mean, and that then will result in an appropriate medical determination that, okay, nothing else needs to be done. We need to refer you. We need to admit you. And later on, it may be used in a criminal proceeding. But don't you agree that there is a medical aspect to that?
There is a medical aspect, certainly, Your Honor. I don't believe that. And who hit you in the head with a 2x4 may be a perfectly relevant question what happened to you? I got hit in the head by a 2x4.
Okay.
Somebody swinging a 2x4 like a baseball bat clopped me in the head. Who swung the baseball bat is completely irrelevant for medical purposes.
I agree with that, yeah.
Just shifting, and perhaps as a segue to your discussion of Dr. Number 2, Dr. Hyden or Dr. Hayden?
Hyden.
Can you tell me, as this is a factual matter, when Nurse Libby Botera, the crisis worker, became involved in the case?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, not a matter that's entirely clear from the record.
Okay. Can you tell me what the significance of a crisis worker being present is?
Well, certainly the significance is that lets everybody know that this is a sexual assault examination and that we are conducting it. As Dr. Hyden himself specifically stated, he is a sexual abuse examiner and that he was conducting a forensic examination. And especially, Your Honor, every member of the court, every member of everybody here knows, forensic means one thing. And that is a criminal investigation.
Well, it is clear from the record that she was attached to or employed by the Sex Abuse Treatment Center at the, however you say it. Cannellani. Do you know what, if any, relationship that center had to the state of Hawaii?
Your Honor, off the top of my brain, I don't. I can certainly come back to that.
Do you know what, if any, relationship that center had or what duties it had under Child Protective Service law or other Hawaii law to report, et cetera, et cetera?
That we certainly do know, Your Honor. They are a mandated reporter, which means that any allegation of child sexual abuse or physical abuse, they are required to report. Your Honor,
I have what's in the JA, but I haven't finished reading the full testimony of Dr. Hyden. Does he say anywhere how many times he testified as an expert or as a factual witness in a child sexual abuse case?
I don't recall him testifying to that particular fact, Your Honor. I can totally check that, but I do recall him saying that he conducted over 1,500 sexual abuse examinations, which I think is relevant for this court's consideration. Certainly check on the other figure.
Is it important that law enforcement wasn't actually involved prior to either examination? I mean, there was no on-the-scene directions or requests by law enforcement?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I would disagree with the premise that law enforcement was not involved. And I would disagree with that premise for a couple of different reasons. First off, as I said, I think we have to look at the form in a general sense first. And the form itself says police report. It's also, it has a form on the bottom, Dr. Hyden's form, for a police report number. Secondly, there was a police report number filled out. So obviously, police were involved in some way. And secondly, Your Honor, as it relates to that, the police on the CID, I think his name escapes me off the top of my brain, was on his way to the Kapiolani Medical Center at the same time that all of this was going on. Somebody obviously notified the police. So I would disagree respectfully, Your Honor, that police were not involved. I think that they clearly were involved. The extent of their involvement is, quite frankly, unfortunately, not clear on the record.
Is the record clear on what the relationship was between law enforcement and the Child Protection Center and the Sex Abuse Treatment Center in particular?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, because, as I said, they are a mandated reporter. They are required to report allegations of sexual abuse. So, therefore, there is a clear connection between the police, whether it be a particular police agency or a particular police officer, and the Kapiolani Medical Center.
Do we know who paid for the exam at the sex abuse?
I don't think that's in the record, Judge. I think common sense would tell me that it was probably paid for by TRICARE, probably paid for by the United States government.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
You're running fairly low on time. Before you finish, would you address harmlessness?
Sure. I would very much like to do so, Judge. The government talked, and I think it's important for this court to remember that when we originally petitioned this court and both before the Army Court, there were other issues raised. We do not, by any stretch of the imagination, concede the DNA in this case. We believe that the DNA is tainted, and we believe that, and I believe that there actually still is a motion pending before the court with regards to some DNA, discovery of some DNA material as it relates to the examiner. And then the other part of that, Your Honors, is the government makes much of the statement made by the appellant. And respectfully, Your Honor, I would argue two things. One is, absent the statements in this case, and of course the DNA, which we can test, the statement made by the accused in and of itself is somewhat irrelevant. But more importantly, Your Honors, I think all of the—
How is it irrelevant?
I'm not sure it's corroborated.
Okay.
You know. But the other,
I mean, that's two different things.
I understand, Judge. But the other part of that, Judge, is, you know, I think it's fairly easy to see what happened during this questioning of the appellant, in which, you know, he's saying, I didn't do anything, and after badgering by the police, he says, you know what, fine, have it your way. If something happened, it was accidental, or, you know, it wasn't on purpose, or whatever. And so I think that, you know, the government, with all due respect to my opposing counsel, they spend an awful lot of time at trial trying to get into evidence the statements made to Dr. Montgomery and to Dr. Hyden. They jump through hoops, they put on evidence. I think it's somewhat, and I don't blame my particular opposing counsel, but the government in a generic sense, as I always prefer to do, somewhat disingenuous for the government to now say, well, none of that evidence was really relevant, none of it mattered. Obviously, if it didn't matter, they would not have spent the amount of time that they spent at trial trying to get it into evidence. Does that address your question, Judge?
Well, counsel, I have.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything about this examination from Montgomery and the second doctor that is out of the ordinary, or is it the standard way all examinations in Hawaii are carried out? When someone comes into the emergency room alleging sexual abuse, is it a standard operating procedure in every case to go through these things? So are we judging the whole statutory and regulatory scheme of dealing with child abuse in Hawaii, or is there something unusual about this case?
Well, I don't know that any cross, I don't know that anybody really questioned it. I'm sure I know the answer to your question, Judge, but I think I can answer it this way. I think that the important thing to remember, especially in response to Judge Ryan's earlier question, as it relates to Dr. Hyden, is the first thing that he did was collected evidence. That, I think, is the distinction. I think it's a distinction with a significant difference. Is if, and I'm not sure about other sexual abuse allegations, Judge, but certainly if somebody comes in with a broken arm, the first thing you don't do is take a statement and say, who broke your arm, who was driving the car, whatever. The first thing you do is you treat that injury. In this case, the first thing they did was collect evidence.
Well, Dr. Hyden. It is part of normal emergency room procedures to do what they call a SOAP. The subjective, what happened, the story, and then the objective is to run tests, and then the A is assess what happened, and the P is prescribe a remedy. So it sounds to me like that's what Dr. Montgomery did here. She found out what happened. She did whatever objectively she could to ascertain it. She assessed the situation and sent the child to the expert.
And again, Judge, I have no qualms with a doctor doing that. Well, I have qualms with whether or not the statement made to that doctor are admissible.
I understand that. I understand that. But there's nothing unusual about what she did in this case. That, in other words, the police didn't say, we have a suspect here. Would you examine the child and see what the child will tell you so we can get that into evidence? That didn't happen here.
Which goes back to my earlier statement to Judge Ryan, which is, we have much greater qualms with the statements to Dr. Hyden than with Dr. Montgomery.
And they didn't send somebody in with an anatomically correct doll and point things out and do all that kind of stuff for the purpose of getting testimony.
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Subject to any further questions? Judge, I'm sorry? Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Getting back to the harmlessness analysis for a minute, how do you deal with the testimony of the mother on JA-24 where she explains basically the same scenarios that the doctor's testimony did as to what happened.
You mean in terms of what SL told her?
Yes. Yeah, and what happened.
Well, Judge, it's certainly another piece of the puzzle that factors into the government's case. But again, I think it's somewhat disingenuous, for lack of a better term, to say that these two statements had absolutely no bearing on the trial. I think it's important for the court to remember, probably the best way I can answer that, Judge, I think it's important for the court to remember that the burden is upon the government. And the burden is upon the government to show that there is no reasonable possibility that this evidence contributed to the finding of guilty. That's what the standard is for harmless error. And frankly, if the government didn't think that these statements would have contributed to a finding of guilty, they wouldn't have put them on as evidence. Judge Baker, do you have a further question?
No.
Okay.
No.
So
thank
any
you.
Further questions by the members of the court? That concludes my presentation.
You'll have time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel for the government.
Counsel, do you know the answers to any of the questions I had for appellant's counsel about the status and relationship between the sex abuse treatment center, the forensic, the crisis worker, and the state of Hawaii?
Your Honor, first turning to the crisis worker, I think Ms. Patera testified record 300 to 305. Only one page of that is in the joint appendix about her nature as the crisis worker. Turning to the relationship between Kapi'olani and the state of Hawaii, early on in Dr. Hyden's testimony at 39A, he testified that CPS, Child Protective Services, and I believe law enforcement do come through Kapi'olani. I think not the hospital, but
the sexual abuse treatment center?
Yes, Your Honor. And just for the record, I'm Captain Edward Whitford, along with Major Rodriguez, representing the government. Just to put that on the record.
What are you doing here?
I'm right. You counsel two.
What's
he
that?
You can be counsel two. He was counsel one.
Yes, Your Honor. SL statements to Dr. Montgomery and Dr. Hyden are not testimonial. Fundamentally, these statements were an 8-year-old patient speaking to doctors.
Could you step back one step further? We have your name now. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you, the appellant said that he was not here to contest the state of the law, that he was standing on Gardinier in light of more recent Supreme Court cases. Is it the government's view that we should, whatever you're about to tell us, apply Gardinier and Bryant to what you're to tell us?
Your Honor, I think the first and third ranking factors are still good law. I think if you're going to switch the primary purpose, it's the primary purpose test in Michigan v. Bryant. That's probably the clearest statement of that the Supreme Court, in a majority opinion, has stated what the primary purpose test is. Rankin 2, I think there's language in Volkoming and in this court in the United States v. Sweeney, the objective catalog or the routine cataloging of objective facts. Volkoming might call into doubt the second Rankin factor, just because a statement can be non-testimonial and be a routine cataloging, a statement can be testimonial and be a routine cataloging. So I think in this case, the first and third Rankin factors, as you looking at Michigan v. Bryant for the primary purpose, I think that's the proper framework to analyze.
So do you want us to change the Rankin test?
Well, I don't know if it's necessary to change it, Your Honor. I just think draw attention to that there's a tension, I think, between Volkoming and Rankin 2, and that in this case, at least, Rankin 1 and 3, along with Michigan v. Bryant, are the appropriate framework.
Is that why the CCA didn't address Rankin 2?
Their own opinion, I think it's a case, Marchesano has said, Rankin 2 is a little important in these types of cases of children talking to doctors.
Yeah, so in terms of the primary purpose test, is it your view that test is satisfied so long as the government witness testifies, my primary purpose in doing X was Y, not Z? Is that enough?
I think that gets it a lot of the way there, Your Honor.
Okay, even if all the rest of the factors point in a completely different direction?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court says we're going to take an objective look at the totality of it. So I think from the doctor's perspective and the declarant's perspective, that's important, but it's also the objective test as well.
So is one of the things that's important with respect to Dr. Hyden that he repeatedly said that he was conducting a forensic exam and that he was looking for forensic evidence?
Well, Your Honor, he did testify that this is a forensic exam, but that doesn't...
Did you agree that a forensic exam, by definition, is an exam for court purposes? I mean, that's the meaning of forensic, isn't it?
Looking at the dictionary, yes, Your Honor. But Your Honor, you'd have to look when the statement was made or the medical history early on.
Let's talk about the medical history. You don't disagree that that Dr. Hyden wasn't just an emergency room doctor, that he was the head of both the sexual abuse treatment center and the child protection center at Capilano, right?
He was, Your Honor.
And both of those entities worked hand in glove with Child Protective Services and other state agencies?
They did, Your Honor.
And you don't disagree that the crisis worker's presence has some significance?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you tell me what the significance is? I mean, she was the person that served as a conduit for the evidence, right, that the doctor collected and turned it over to law enforcement?
Yes, Your Honor, but she didn't elicit the statement.
No, I understand that, but she was present.
She was present, but I don't, Your Honor, those facts and the fact don't undercut what Dr. Hyden's primary purpose was.
Well, you don't disagree that before Dr. Hyden ever examined her that an authorization for release of evidence form was filled out?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't disagree with that.
And that as the doctor was examining her, he was filling out blocks on the Hawaii State medical legal record?
Yes, Your Honor.
And none of that concerns you in terms of what his purpose was?
Well,
why don't you state the argument on either side so that we have the benefit of both of you?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. The military judge made findings of facts in this case, and she acknowledged that Dr. Hyden was collecting evidence. The military judge made a finding that didn't turn this medical examination, the medical history, into a law enforcement exam. So the military judge made findings of fact in that regard.
Did her findings of fact address any of the issues that I just asked you about?
They don't, Your Honor. They don't address...
Do you agree that under state law cases that have addressed this exact issue, that all of those factors are important?
Your Honor, I don't disagree that it's a totality of the circumstances, but the totality of the circumstances show that Dr. Hyden has a medical purpose. He says that the medical history is the most important, quote, most important. It's a predicate of treating a patient, and he did treat a patient here. He prescribed her antibiotics. He referred her for further counseling. based on the medical history. He examined SL and found evidence of trauma. So this is not a law enforcement. As Dr. Hyden testified repeatedly, his primary purpose is a doctor treating the patient. The primary purpose is not a singular purpose, Your Honor. And Dr. Hyden was a doctor practicing the medical arts, and his primary purpose was not creating an out-of-court substitute for trial testimony.
The child had already been to one physician.
Yes, sir.
Presumably for treatment.
Well, it's a different kind of treatment, Your Honor. Emergency room.
Well, it sounds like, you know, emergency room treatment and police treatment. Well, I mean, it sort of sounds like, okay, here's treatment over here, and now we'll send her over here and start gathering evidence.
I disagree with that.
Okay, tell me why it isn't that.
Didn't Dr. Montgomery testify that there was no bleeding and that she seemed stable when she sent to the second doctor?
She did, Your Honor, but Dr. Montgomery also testified that she wanted that her duty as an emergency room physician is to take a history, do an examination, then make a disposition, which can include further care. She didn't have the expertise to conduct an internal examination. She sent that to a subsequent pediatric doctor who has that expertise, and Dr. Hyden's expertise shouldn't hit that his expertise as a doctor shouldn't negate to say that he's such an expert as a doctor that it has to be a law enforcement purposes. His medical expertise is relevant to show his primary purpose as a doctor.
But if his medical expertise is such that his primary function in life is to examine children for child sexual abuse and testify about that at trial, don't you think that tips the balance as to what the primary purpose of his exam was?
No, Your Honor, I don't. The record is not clear how many times he testified. He's testified the 39A and on the merits.
Well, I noticed that the government didn't ask that question.
No, they did not, Your Honor, qualifying him as an expert. But Dr. Montgomery had a limited purpose, Your Honor, as an emergency room physician. She saw that the patient was stable, lack of bleeding, and she said, it's medically prudent to send this patient to a doctor who has expertise in pediatric, including pediatric sexual assault. And there's a clear medical purpose for that, and this is not a subterfuge. I don't think the record supports that, and I don't think the military judge should make any findings of fact that this is a subterfuge to send.
It's not necessarily a subterfuge, but the question is, what's the primary purpose of the second examination? If the child has received care, you know, basic care in the first examination, and she's sent on to a place which specializes in sexual abuse, and is a reporting entity, and receives both medical care, you know, how does that parse? The child receives medical care, but the entity also has a testimonial purpose. How do we weigh that?
I think you look at.
The law seems to assume that there is a primary purpose, and we can divine it. So I'm trying to divine it. What's the primary purpose of the second examination?
The primary purpose of the second examination is treating, is taking a medical history of SL, treating her, and then subsequent examining her, treating her, and then Dr. Hyden administered a rape kit.
And what are your three, four, one best evidentiary bases for concluding that?
For Dr. Hyden, Your Honor, first?
Yeah, I get your argument, but what backs it up?
There's a temporal aspect for it, too, that the medical history happened early on, and that in the context of this medical history of an 8-year-old patient speaking to a doctor, the primary purpose of that is medical in nature. The primary purpose test is not a singular purpose test. Dr. Hyden was aware that this information could go to law enforcement, but it didn't. That possibility doesn't overwhelm his primary purpose in treating this patient. The rape kit that Dr. Hyden administered happened later on during this examination. Law enforcement didn't even make contact with Capilani until Dr. Hayden had finished as well.
So is that one argument, two arguments? Go through your checklist. I just want to make sure you get your checklist down.
I think number one is the medical purpose of the history. Two is the temporal. Three is that law enforcement has not been brought there, did not make contact with Capilani until after the examination.
Do you think that the absence of law enforcement into the equation until after the exam is completed, you know, shields this from being testimonial? Did that factor alone shield it from being testimonial?
Well, I think it helps, Your Honor. I don't. It's probably not dispositive, but this, for example,
so,
this case.
So do you think that in response to our case in Gardner, whatever the G case,
yes, sir.
That where we suggested that the fact that law enforcement had initiated the same nurse's examination, that the response to law enforcement then was like, well, we won't get involved till after the same nurse examination or till after the examination by the Sex Abuse Treatment Center. And then it's not Gardner?
This case is not Gardner, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. If you look at Gardner, one of the questions that...
I'm not asking that question. I asked you a different question, which is, do you think that by law enforcement not getting involved until after the fact that is dispositive as to whether something is testimonial or not, because it seems that would be a simple way to evade Gardner.
Well, I, Your Honor, it's highly, highly relevant. I, in a totality of circumstances, I don't think any one fact is dispositive, but the fact that law enforcement didn't make contact until after is highly relevant on term for ranking one and for ranking three.
Do we know enough about the significance or the work or the employer, and when I say the employer, like who employed the crisis worker, to know that she was not a proxy for law enforcement? I mean, do we know that from the record?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think you, but...
So we'd be speculating?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd have to review the record on that, but...
I haven't been able to find it.
I don't think it's in there, Your Honor. I just don't want to say that it's not in the, try to prove up a negative here.
And your primary arguments for why the primary purpose was medical and not something else are, one, the thing started with the medical history.
Yes, Your Honor.
Two, it sounds like the same argument that was the first thing that was done before the rape kit. And three, that law enforcement came in after. Is that your complete list?
I think those are the three strongest.
I just want to make sure so that the appellant has the opportunity on rebuttal to specifically address each of those arguments.
Yes, Your Honor. And when the temporal and the medical history are connected, because the medical history is what Dr. Hayden testified is the most important part, and that happened early on. And
something that's not medical history is what? Rape history, or what would a doctor otherwise be doing?
Well, I think it would be something like the nurse in Gardner who said, can you tell me what you told the policeman? I think that would be going outside of a medical history to get around. That's different than what Dr. Hayden eliciting a statement that SL had pain when she peed and then or spoke to the doctor about what happened.
And counsel, just to be clear, the medical history that you're talking about, is this the medical history that is annotated on the Hawaii State Medical Legal Record and Sexual Assault Information form?
Your Honor, I think
that's the form that the doctor used to take the medical history, isn't it?
He did use, but the ultimate statement.
How does that cut against your argument that the medical history was taken first, the fact that it was taken on a medical legal record and sexual assault information form?
Well, Your Honor, Dr. Hayden testified that he sees the form as exactly that medical precedes legal. And he says, I look at the form, it says medical first, legal second, and it's not a lawyer, it's not a nurse administering this, it's a doctor. And he treats it as a doctor performing his healing arts.
Counsel, it seems to me that it could be argued anyway rather than testing what happened individually in this case with the two doctors and what was said and everything, what's really at issue is whether the scheme they used to investigate sexual abuse in the state of Hawaii violates the Sixth Amendment. Because there's nothing out of the ordinary about this, is it? I mean, this is the same. If any child comes in there, they go through this same process, don't they? Dr. One makes a preliminary examination. If she says, well, gee, it might be sexual abuse, she sends him to Dr. Two, who then does a forensic exam. If he concludes the child was not abused, that's the end of it. If he concludes the child was abused, they call in law enforcement. Every case. And the question is, what can they do with the evidence that they gather during that process? And it would seem to me that the argument can be made the Sixth Amendment does not allow them to come in and testify about that when a child is 8 years old and can come testify herself.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the record says one way or the other that this is what they did in every case in Hawaii. But
there's nothing unusual about this case that would stand out. We could put our arms around and say, gee, look what Dr. Montgomery did. That's really bad. Or really good.
Not really, Your Honor. They didn't. Dr. Montgomery and Dr. Hyden testified that what they did was consistent with typical cases. Yeah.
Well, somebody said he had done 1,500 of them.
Yes, Your Honor. 1,000 to 1,500. Dr. Hyde, the second doctor,
yeah,
testified.
So that and obviously is a process they use at that jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as he testifies what he was told in every one of those cases?
I just think it's a slight disagreement that I have with you, sir, just that the record doesn't say that this is what we did in every case in Hawaii. But
okay.
I think I can agree that the doctors perform consistently with what they've done in the past.
Counsel, could you spend the remaining time giving your best reasons why, assuming that we disagree with you about the statements to Dr. Hyden, I'm not saying that we do, but just assuming that fact, what are your three best reasons as to why the admission of the statements to Dr. Hyden are harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, Your Honor, it's the strength of the government's case and the cumulative nature of Dr. Hyden's testimony with Dr. Montgomery. The government believes the statement of Dr. Montgomery is not testimonial, and Dr. Hyden's testimony is consistent with that. So that would be one Van Arsdale factor. And most importantly, it's the overwhelming evidence. Appellant confessed to CID, and he was told he was suspected of raping a child, and he told the police, quote, if his DNA was found on or in the victim, then his penis did penetrate her. And second, appellant's semen and DNA were found in the 8-year-old's vagina and on her underwear. And so that evidence is overwhelming, and no rational jury or all rational juries would convict on that. This is using the Van Arsdale test for harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt or the Nader test beyond a reasonable doubt. The evidence is overwhelming, and Dr. Hyden says that his testimony is cumulative with Dr. Montgomery as well. And pending any further questions, I'll briefly conclude. The government asks that this court affirm the Army Corps.
That was brief.
Thank you very much.
You.
Counsel for the appellant.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I'll be as brief as counsel, too, as he will forever be remembered now, so. Judge Ryan, I'd like to address one of the questions that you addressed earlier with me, and I think Captain Whiteford adequately addressed it, but I did want to point out to you two parts of the record that are extremely relevant. One is that record page 301, Ms. Botero said that she counseled the mother, MSL, right before the exam and prepared them for the exam and now I can't read my handwriting, and helped Dr. Hyde with the collection of evidence. And again, Your Honor, that key word is evidence. And secondly, Your Honor, on record page 307, it is Ms. Botero who transferred the results of that evidence collection to CID agents. Those two factors, I think, are extremely relevant and takes the, we believe it resolves any ambiguity as to whether this was made in response to a law enforcement or a prosecutorial inquiry and what was the primary purpose, and tilts them in favor of the appellant. Your Honor, in regard to Judge Baker, with regards to, I'm going to address the two questions that you had and then the three factors that you asked the government to address. When SL left Dr. Montgomery, She was, as Dr. Montgomery said, hemodynamically stable. And that term wasn't defined in the record of trial, but I think the plain meaning is there was certainly no medical emergency at that point that required further treatment. And secondly,
Dr. Montgomery didn't feel she was qualified to conduct the pediatric examination.
The forensic pediatric examination, that's correct.
Yeah.
Which is, again, which is why I think that as it relates to Dr. Hyden, that tipped the scales in favor of the appellant, because she was sent there for a forensic examination and on JA page 106 to collect evidence. That was the purpose. Judge Baker, I would like to respond to your question, if I understood the question correctly, as it relates to, I think you asked for three things that sort of tipped the scales one way or the other. And we would I would point the court to the following. One, the SO was referred specifically for a forensic examination. As Judge Ryan pointed out and as government counsel conceded, forensic has one meaning and one meaning only. That is for a criminal investigation. The two.
Just to be clear, the second doctor was also a specialist, however, in pediatric care, correct?
That is correct.
So it's the word forensic you're focusing on.
But yes, as it relates to the first of the three things that you asked me for, yes, Your Honor.
So if you refer someone to a specialist, that doesn't automatically make it forensic?
No, certainly not, Judge. Certainly not.
Okay.
The second one would be that the first thing that he did, I wrote this down in my notes, I'm not sure I gave you a page number, however, is the first thing that he did is he collected evidence. And he says that he collected evidence prior to doing a swab for an STD.
Okay, now here we have a fundamental disagreement between the government and the appellant on how you read the record. The government's first argument as to primary purpose is the first thing Dr. Hayden did was take a medical history, and your statement is the first thing he did was collect evidence. What are you going to cite to in the record that will result in us saying you've got it right and the government has it wrong?
JA page 106, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I guess, Your Honor,
you have a list. I don't want you to lose it.
Yes, Your Honor. And the third part is that this information was then turned over to law enforcement. And again, Your Honor, I'd like to take a step back and look at the bigger picture of the forms themselves as they are used. The forms are, and Dr. Hyden's, I don't think the nomenclature between Dr. 1 and Dr. 2 is all that relevant, but these are medico-legal forms. These are forensic forms. And I think it's important for the court to understand that the question isn't whether or not Dr. in response to the senior judge's question, is this just something that you normally do in cases? We have no qualms with whether or not you conduct a particular type of examination. The question is whether or not the information elicited during that examination, to what degree is it admissible under the Sixth Amendment? Which would bring me right back to the first thing I said, one of the first things I said before the court, is if somebody comes in and says, I got hit by a baseball bat, that is relevant for a doctor's inquiry. For that person to come into court and say, Bill Casera hit me over the head with a baseball bat, violates the Sixth Amendment, it violates U.S. v. Gardinier, and it violates Rankin. For those reasons, I'm sorry, Judge Ryan, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Subject to any further questions of the court.
I have one question.
Please.
Apropos harmless error analysis. Assume we agree with you that the statements violated the Confrontation Clause, admission of those. What about the evidence he collected, the physical evidence?
Well, I think it's fruit of the, I think it's all, not, fruit of the poisonous tree is not, those are the words that first came out of my mouth, and as soon as I put them, I wanted to pull them back.
What's the poisonous tree? There's nothing unlawful.
Words left my mouth, I wanted to pull them back, yeah. That's not what I meant to say.
There's nothing unlawful about him questioning the child, examining the child, all that. What we're focused on is whether he can come into court and testify.
That's correct, Jim. And that's
but what about what he actually found? We can consider that case.
I would argue that, yeah, I would concede that the court could consider that, the evidence itself.
Okay.
Subject to any further questions from the court, that concludes my presentation.
All right. The court case is now submitted. The court thanks both counsel for your arguments today, and we'll stand in recess until 25 past the hour. Thank you very much.
The court stands in recess until 10:25 a.m.